It is a new public phase of the impeachment inquiry into President Trump, and we're getting up to speed here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. The House committees leading the impeachment inquiry released the first transcripts yesterday of closed-door depositions into President Trump's dealings with Ukraine. So have you been paying attention to the testimony happening on Capitol Hill? What questions do you have about what we've learned so far? Do you support the House voting to formalize the inquiry? We're at 800-642-1234. Elisa von Hagel is an associate professor of political science and teaches American government and gender studies at the UW Superior, and she joins us from our studios in Superior. Elisa, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me again.
So last week, the impeachment inquiry passed this milestone with the first formal vote on the floor of the House of Representatives, 232 to 196. Resolution passes. What does formalizing this inquiry mean?
It means basically that the Democrats have established a process, a very clearly laid out process and plan for how this inquiry or investigation up to leading to impeachment will proceed. And so it lays out how, you know, Democrats and Republicans have equal questioning time in closed door meetings, how they are able to request subpoenas and witnesses, and basically just lay out the basic parameters of how this inquiry or investigation by the House Intelligence Committee is going to proceed.
Okay, so there was already this inquiry happening before this vote. People were testifying almost daily. So what does the vote change as we head into this public phase?
Well, so the vote was, I guess it wasn't necessarily a legal process or legal measure that they had to go through. The House can engage in this inquiry at any stage without formalizing through a vote. The Democrats held this vote largely in reaction to a lot of the negative press that they were receiving about the secrecy of the closed door meetings that were occurring, of the president's absence of due process rights. And so I think a lot of the claims that were being leveled against them in this inquiry process, they wanted to establish a very clear, you know, upfront, out, you know, process and made it for the first time for public. And so what we've seen again this yesterday, and we'll see more today, are the first of the transcripts from some of these closed door meetings. And so we're moving also from a largely closed door phase of the investigation to a more public, open part of the investigation.
And when you look at process, Elisa, the inquiry now gives the president's attorneys the ability to cross-examine witnesses. Have we seen this before in impeachment proceedings?
Well, it's, so there's been very few impeachments of the president. There's only been two U.S. presidents who have been impeached by the House. And because the Constitution is fairly, I would say, vague, or they, you know, there's not very clear parameters in terms of the process of the House, the process of the Senate. And so largely the House is free to conduct the inquiry as well as, you know, the impeachment as they deem fit. And so it's not necessarily something new, but it's also, you know, it's not necessarily a problem that if it's something new as well, because each impeachment seems to be slightly different from the last.
We're getting up to speed on the impeachment inquiry with Wisconsin political scientist Elisa von Hagel as our guide. You can join in. Have you been able to keep up with the practically daily testimonies? Do you support the House voting to formalize this inquiry? Do you think it should have happened sooner or not at all? We're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So yesterday, four White House officials declined to appear before House committees in these closed-door testimony. But what have the witnesses said about why they aren't testifying?
Well, some of them have not stated anything. They've just not shown. Many of them are speaking through their lawyer. So it depends. Each of these witnesses are different. We have John Bolton, the former NSC advisor. He has been summoned by the House, but he said he would not testify unless subpoenaed, unless forced to be there. We have Eisenberg, who was supposed to testify
John
yesterday.
John Eisenberg.
Yeah, uh-huh. John Eisenberg, excuse me, was supposed to testify yesterday, a top NSC lawyer. He did not appear, and his lawyer stated that there's, you know, the president declared absolute immunity over the Trump's his closest advisors, and thus determined that they are not to testify before Congress. And so many of these individuals are stuck between the, you know, executive branch saying that you are not to testify, whereas Congress is asking them to testify. And so there are a handful of individuals through their lawyers are filing a lawsuit to have the federal courts tell them, what do they do? Which branch supersedes the other? And so it's very chaotic at times, it seems, but it's every individual is different in terms of how they're dealing with their summons or subpoena to testify.
Let's bring in Patrick now in Richland County. Hi, Patrick. What's on your mind here?
Well, good morning and great show, ladies. What's on my mind this morning is the rule of law. And I was just wondering if the guest thought that the rule of law was under attack. And one other kind of a rhetorical question. I know for myself, I recognize and appreciate now the institutions of democracy before 45 came along. But the rule of law, is it under attack? Thank you.
Patrick, thanks for the call. Elisa, how would you address that in terms of what is under attack here?
Well, with respect to the impeachment proceedings, there have been assertions that, this is a violation of due process, is a violation of rights of, and it has been going about in an improper manner. But again, because of the way that the Constitution lays out the impeachment process, the House has been very upfront and very clear in terms of why and how they're proceeding forward, and they are working strictly within the bounds of the Constitution.
Yesterday, House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff told the press this would be used as further evidence of obstruction of justice with not having these White House officials appear to testify. So does refusing to comply with subpoenas, does it hurt the president's case here?
Well, that's hard to say. And so in terms of the, you know, strict letter of the law, obstruction of justice by refusing to testify under a subpoena would constitute a obstruction of justice in this matter. Whether or not that would hurt the president in the court of public opinion or even amongst senators who will perhaps, if the House votes to impeach, would be deciding his fate or his removal from office. And so there's many different sort of ways of thinking about how that affects the president. And so, again, while it's, again, Biden is strictly within the rule of law and would very much match what the Constitution would outlined, intended that impeachment was to deal with, whether or not that actually hurts the president is yet to be seen.
Remains to be seen. Yeah. And Schiff has said that these obstacles are, quote, not going to delay our work. He said he's suggesting White House officials, you know, they're going to the work of the committees are going to carry on regardless of whether, you know, these people show up to testify or not. We're talking with UW Superior political scientist Elisa von Hagel about the impeachment inquiry as it enters a new public phase. You can join in with questions. Do you have about the inquiry? Are you concerned that the White House, the House vote was partisan? Will you watch televised testimony to come? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to this conversation in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We are getting an update on the impeachment inquiry into President Trump. As House investigators yesterday released the first transcripts of closed-door depositions, we've seen now four White House officials defy subpoenas to testify. So what is your take on White House officials refusing to comply with subpoenas? Have you been paying attention to the testimony so far? What are your thoughts? Join in 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Elisa Von Hagel is our guide. She's an associate professor of political science at UW-Superior. Let's go back to the phones now. Keith is joining us from Beaver Dam. Hi, Keith.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering about this whistleblower had heard this secondhand. So I thought there was a protocol to follow. They changed that in August, I guess, and it made it easier for anybody to come forward now, I guess. I have a problem with that, and it's just the coordination between the whistleblower and Adam Schiff with in regards to setting this all up with attorneys and everything. And secondly, I understand some of these people that are being subpoenaed or called to the White House aren't always allowed to have representative attorney there to represent them too. So it's kind of, I can understand why somebody wouldn't go under questioning if they couldn't have somebody there, an attorney or representative, for questioning.
Yeah, Keith, thanks so much. Two-part question there, Elisa. First, the whistleblower, this unidentified CIA officer who filed a complaint alleging misconduct during the president's July phone call. What do we know about the whistleblower at this point?
For some people, it seems maddeningly very little. We still are unaware of who the person's identity is. We do know that there are two whistleblowers that have come forward from the White House who work within the White House and who have reported seeing this transcript of the phone call through, again, as you mentioned, the transcript, not hearing it firsthand, being on the line, but seeing the transcript. And they are completely anonymous. It's at this point, it seems to be the fact that members of Congress do not know who this person is, and it is very clear that this person has representation to ensure their anonymity, their protection, given the very real threats that they've received already against their life.
And then the other aspect, Keith, is asking about rank-and-file employees, advisors, and assistants being called to testify. They are also seeking counsel. So how does that work?
Well, while we talk about impeachment in the terminology that we use for perhaps, say, criminal crimes or crimes that are tried in a court of law, this is not a criminal trial; it's an impeachment trial. And so it's legal in the sense that there's a process outlined in the Constitution, but this isn't a criminal legal process. And so these individuals are not being subpoenaed to testify. It doesn't necessarily hold the same weight as it would in a criminal court. And so some of the basic general protections or established protocols that we have for criminal prosecutions don't hold or don't carry aren't present in this impeachment process, just given the nature of the impeachment process itself.
We're getting up to speed on the impeachment inquiry with political scientist Elisa Von Hagel as our guide. What questions do you have about the impeachment inquiry process? Join in 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Kayla now in Madison with thoughts on this. Hi, Kayla.
Hi there. I have two questions about kind of the process and then the aftermath. My first question is, how long is this expected to take? And then the second part is, we have an election coming up, so if this impeachment goes through, what happens for conservatives? Do they have to, is Pence their candidate? Do we, pick another one?
Kayla, thank you so much for those questions. Really specifically here about the timeline on this, Elisa, what is the timeline?
Oh, I wish I knew. So it does seem to appear that the Democrats are moving fairly swiftly through this inquiry phase. And so it's anticipated. Again, there's no exact timeline that they have to follow. when Bill Clinton was impeached, the Ken Starr investigation took over 2 years to, you know, occur. And so they're not going to take 2 years, hopefully. But I think there's been talk of having an impeachment vote in the House by the end of November and then moving to a Senate trial, if not in the end, towards the end of December, if the started the beginning of January. And so it looks like they are wanting to move fairly quickly through these phases of the impeachment vote and thus then moving to the Senate for the trial. With respect to the second question, mm-hmm. when it comes to the election, this is occurring within election season, and if the president is acquitted, the president is free to run for office and to maintain his office as long as he sees fit within this 2-term parameters. If he is removed from office by the Senate, then he is not eligible to run for this next election cycle. And whether or not conservatives have determined or found a replacement candidates is yet to be seen at this point anyway. There's no discussion or public discussion of it as of yet.
So going back to the testimony here, the biggest name on the House committee's list perhaps this week is former National Security Advisor John Bolton, scheduled to testify Thursday. What might he be able to provide the committee about the Ukraine phone call or military aid?
Well, I think John Bolton is I wouldn't say loose cannon, but it's a little unclear as to what necessarily he would provide. He left the White House in sort of awkward terms. He was very much opposed to the president in certain foreign policy matters. And what we do know thus far is that Bolton was opposed to the president's or the use of the president's personal lawyer, Giuliani, specifically. And his Giuliani's involvement in Ukraine in dealing with, certain business issues, as well as dealing with this foreign aid issue that obviously has prompted the impeachment inquiry in the first place. And so he was opposed to Giuliani's involvement and saw it as problematic. As to what, he can add to the conversation, it's still unclear as, what details he can fill in or what gaps he can fill.
Let's bring in Chad now in Galena, Illinois. Hi, Chad.
Hello. How are you?
Good. What's on your mind?
Earlier, you stated that this isn't technically a criminal case. And in a criminal case, when someone's subpoenaed, there are consequences for not responding. What are the consequences for not responding to a subpoena in this type of case?
Alisa?
Well, yeah. So it goes to court. It goes to the federal courts, and so the problem is with that is, of course, that it has to go through the court system, which is a process. It's a lengthy process, and so it simply is something that takes time. There are the two advisors within the White House that have been subpoenaed. They have filed suit with the federal court, asking them to weigh in and say which supersedes the other branch, Congress or the president. And I think the hearings stated or are stated to begin in December 10th. So, again, that's sort of the only arbiter as of right now we have. And that is the determining factor in terms of whether or not these individuals, are held to this subpoena or are, again, the president supersedes that request by the House.
Alisa, Republicans in Congress have called the impeachment inquiry a sham. The president has called it a witch hunt. What are they getting at by criticizing this process?
Well, it's very clearly following the exact parameters that are laid out in the Constitution. They are following pretty much the rules established by the Republican Congress in 2015. So it's clear, at least it seems to be the fact that by challenging the process, they're not discussing the actual content or the issue at hand. So there doesn't seem to be a lot of Republicans defending the president's actions in this particular case. But what they are challenging or what they are trying to fight against is the process itself. And so even after we had the vote on Thursday, which laid out the process quite clearly, we still see these same challenges of process, rather than actually starting to grapple with what it means to have the president you know, basically using foreign aid for, as a means to incur foreign personal favors from other foreign dignitaries.
Lots to keep your eye on here. What are you watching for most closely as a political scientist?
Oh, everything. Absolutely. I mean, every day is, I think there was someone who mentioned it, but every day there's just so much that comes out, and it's hard to sift through and find those kernels of, you know, of value or information. But what I think is very interesting is to see the shift in public opinion that's occurred and to watch how that proceeds. We see the majority of Americans did not support impeachment. Now they do. Whether that holds, that's the question I think that will be on everyone's mind.
Alisa, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me this morning.
Alisa von Hagel is an associate professor of political science at UW-Superior, and she's been giving us an update on the impeachment inquiry and the latest on Capitol Hill. She joined us from our studios in Superior. Coming up, we check in on the state of public transportation around Wisconsin with two advocates. What does public transportation look like in your community? Is there enough? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll talk transportation after this news update here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about public transportation across Wisconsin here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So we're looking at the gaps in our state's transportation system that affect people who are unable to drive, who can't afford to drive, or maybe who desire an alternative to driving. And we're having this conversation at a time when WPR is doing this deep dive into high-speed rail with our new podcast called Derailed. What questions do you have about public transportation in our state? What do you want to know? Are you a public transit rider? Do you ever take a bus or rail service to your job or school? How do you use public transit? We're at 800-642-1234. Cassie Steiner is a campaign coordinator for the Wisconsin chapter of the Sierra Club. Cassie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
And Lisa Jones is lead organizer for Milwaukee Inner City Congregations Allied for Hope. They're known as MICA. Lisa, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with you, Lisa. For people outside Milwaukee or for people who don't use public transportation, can you help us understand the options available to Milwaukee residents?
Well, currently, of course, driving is always an option for those who are privileged to have cars and to be able to afford to drive them. There are also two bus options that are available in Milwaukee County. Unfortunately, they're not fully funded, and over the years, there's been divestment over the last 25 years in public transportation. So that has limited people being able to get to jobs. And currently in Milwaukee, in some zip codes, we have some zip codes that have 20% to 43% of people that do not own cars. So that gets to be a very big concern as to the public transportation for people to get to and from work and to doctor's appointments, to seniors, to the disabled. So it's a very big concern here in Milwaukee.
Cassie, how are the public transit options different in cities like, say, Wausau or La Crosse? How are they compared with bigger cities like the Milwaukee, like the Madison?
I think a couple notable differences is that Milwaukee has a countywide transit system, and then Madison partners with a lot of communities. Recently, a partnership with Sun Prairie started, but existing relationships with Fitchburg and Verona. So we're seeing bigger systems go beyond city limits, whereas smaller transit systems, with a couple more rural examples, not crossing city lines quite as much.
And when you don't cross city lines or when you don't cross county lines, what happens?
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of people struggling to get to where they need. A lot of growth is happening outside of city centers or in more small community areas outside of the hubs of our small cities like Eau Claire and La Crosse. And so we're seeing big job hubs not being connected to the base of workers, and that's a big gap for people who are trying to get to work.
So are there cities in Wisconsin with no public transit options that have enough demand or need to support those services?
Yeah, most counties in Wisconsin have some form of paratransit or specialized transportation, but that is specific for people with disabilities or the elderly. And so if you are a young person or you're in a rural area and your car breaks down, you have to depend on your neighbors to get you where you need to go. And if they're busy, if they also have a job, that's a real challenge and a real barrier. And I think something that's really stood out for me as I do this work is that some of the more rural transit systems are so excited to expand. When we look at Bayfield and Ashland's transit system that covers multiple counties and is serving a really rural population, there's great appetite there for expansion. And so we're seeing both our urban and rural areas really request strengthening our public transportation systems.
You know, we've heard people say they use transit to get to work or school or the grocery store. Where is the greatest need for transit to help people connect with where they need to go?
Yeah, I mean, I think wherever anyone with a car might want to go is where the need is. And so, you know, we talk about jobs and we talk about healthcare because that's a matter of quality of life and livelihood, but being able to get to the movie theaters and have a social connection. As Wisconsin ages, we're seeing seniors cut off from social opportunities. And so I think there's an all-around need to connect people to other people and to opportunities. And
we're talking about public transportation with two advocates, Cassie Steiner there from the Sierra Club and Lisa Jones from the Milwaukee Inner City Congregations Allied for Hope. It's known as MICA. You can join in. How do you feel about public transportation that's going on in your community? Are there enough options for you? Would you support more bus lines or more frequent buses or other service expansions? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Lisa, in Milwaukee, why do people typically use public transit rather than driving or walking, perhaps?
Well, there are a number of different reasons. You may have people who are environmentally conscious. That may be one option. There are people who just don't want to drive at all. But one of the biggest reasons that we're seeing in Milwaukee is because people just don't have the financial means to be able to purchase a car, to be able to put gas in a car, to have insurance. Those are all things that when you have more money, you're able to do those things. And then also, too, if you are disabled and you don't have the physical means to be able to drive, you may need to be able to rely solely on public transportation to get you to and from work or to and from your health appointment.
You approach, Lisa, public transportation from a racial justice perspective. Can you explain a little bit about where you're coming from on this?
Well, when we're talking about where money goes and how it can benefit people the most, we currently, a lot of what has been happening is the monies have been going into roads. And, of course, we do need roads. We do need highways. But is that the best mode of transportation for people to be able to get around in their local communities? What if we had options that were like rail systems where people didn't have to get in their cars and go from one place to the other? What we also forget about is that people who live in larger metropolitan areas, because there are more cars on the road, they're actually breathing, you know, more pollution that comes from cars versus some other areas. And when you have populations like Milwaukee that is primarily black and brown, 63% of the population, that becomes a racial justice issue, just even the air quality. These are things that people just really don't think about, and it's time that we really need to start thinking about how are we doing our transportation that is equitable so that everybody can be able to get to and from wherever they need to go.
Let's bring in Carol now, joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Carol.
Good morning. My comment is that I think public transportation can never get anywhere or has a very hard time getting anywhere as far as good, really good public transportation, because there are many business interests, especially car companies, which would really be in big trouble if we would get good public transportation. I've been taking the bus for 50 years, and so far there has not been any improvement. So I think it's one of those very difficult, like health care. It's hard to get Medicare for All because it's against very big, huge interests.
So, Carol, you've been taking the bus for a half century in Milwaukee, and you say there's been little change in how bus service has been over those decades.
It has gotten worse under Walker. It got worse. He thought everybody should have a car. He said that one time. Yes, it has gotten worse, but as far as getting better in Milwaukee, it really hasn't. For 50 years, it's actually worse, and it was bad when I started. So,
Lisa, is Carol's sentiment there? Do you hear echoes of that as you look at this issue?
Definitely echoes of that. But the divestment of in transportation in Milwaukee has been really drastic. I agree, over the Walker era. Just look at how much, even when he was county executive, we used to have freeway flyers. We used to have more freeway flyers that would make it easier for people to get from one side of town to the other.
And explain what freeway flyers are.
Well, I remember years ago, and I actually took the freeway flyer, there used to be one that used to go down Fond du Lac Avenue, and Fond du Lac Avenue is like a key angle street in the Milwaukee area on the northwest side of Milwaukee. And you would be able to take that freeway flyer and be able to get easily from one side of town, not nearly downtown, to the other side in a very short period of time. Well, due to funding cuts and things like that, divestment, that freeway flyer was gone. And so, you know, that changes the way people have to take the bus. And so instead of taking maybe one bus that could get you quickly to and from your job or wherever you need to go, then you may be talking about two or three buses. And when you're talking about that, we don't think about the quality of life issues. So if you're talking about a single mom who is trying to, let's say, get to parent-teacher conferences, and it takes her an additional hour to get from to and from, and then she's got to go to her child's school, it becomes a really big quality of life issues when those buses get cut.
We're talking about the future of public transportation in Wisconsin and the reality on the ground in our communities right now. Lisa Jones, who is talking there, is with MICA, the Milwaukee Inner City Congregations Allied for Hope. We're also talking with Cassie Steiner on this issue. She's a campaign coordinator for the Sierra Club. You can join in. What questions or insights do you have about public transit in our state? How do you feel about high-speed rail? Should lawmakers revisit this issue or move on? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll get back to this in just a minute. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. WPR News has a new podcast. It's called Derailed. Episode 5 is out tomorrow. It's a deep dive into how high-speed rail almost came to our state and the politics behind it. You can find Derailed wherever you get your podcasts and at WPR.org. So right now, we're exploring public transportation across Wisconsin with your questions, your stories. What are you encountering out there? 800-642-1234. Sierra Club's Cassie Steiner stays with us, and Lisa Jones, the organizer for Milwaukee Inner City Congregations Allied for Hope, or MICA, she's here too. Let's go back to the phones now. Joyce is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Joyce.
Hi there. My comment and question is, you know, I was at the Milwaukee County budget hearing last night, and 2.5 hours of testimony, 80% of the people talked about the need for bus transportation and restoring the cuts that we've had in our own bus system here. But we have to follow the money. In Milwaukee County, we can't even raise the sales tax that might be possible to fund more transit without going to the state. And it's been a problem. The state has been cutting transportation funds for transit. 80% of the monies, and it was said earlier, goes to roads and construction, 20% to transit, and we've seen cuts of 20% over the last few years. What can we do as communities across Wisconsin to address the state in terms of our needs and get some kind of progress in terms of getting adequate funding for transit, including a dedicated fund that's that many states around the country have?
Joyce, thanks for the call. As you follow the money there and go to the hearings, you know, Milwaukee County, Cassie, has been considering this budget proposal that would reduce some bus services. What do you see there?
I'll let Lisa talk a little bit about the local impacts of what's playing out in the local government there. But when I look at this, I think Joyce is absolutely right that we're seeing this divestment at the state level in transit, and this has been happening for a decade. This past state budget, we saw our first public transportation increase, and it wasn't enough to make up for the cuts that happened around 2010, and it wasn't enough to keep up with 1 year of inflation. And so even though we saw an increase for the first time in a decade this past budget, we're still losing money out of our transit systems. And so the cuts we're seeing in Milwaukee, the unpopular wheel tax that Madison is considering, Eau Claire and the bus system in Bayfield not being able to expand even though they want to. These are all examples of how local governments are faced with a really difficult choice when it comes to public transportation, and there are so many legal barriers from the state in what they can do to leverage funds to pay for this, even if they really want it and the community needs it. And I think what we're seeing play out is this decade's of trend in divestment.
Lisa, how would Milwaukee be affected by fewer bus lines and the proposals that are on the table right now?
Well, really, people can't get to their jobs. I mean, that's really the bottom line to that. You're asking people to take additional buses. And in some cases, you know, when we're talking about where the buses go, some buses have already been cut, like the job lines that they were going out to Waukesha and to New Berlin that were getting people to those types of jobs in the Waukesha County area. Those bus lines have been cut because of funding concerns, and so the people who are getting those jobs have to find alternative ways. I mean, what are they going to do, Uber? I mean, that is not a viable option if we want to talk about creating beloved community and having people be able to contribute, to be taxpayers. We really have to think about how we are funding this, and also to think about the kind of relationships that really need to happen with our sister counties so that people really can be getting to and from the job. So if someone lives in Milwaukee, but we know that in the New Berlin area, in the Waukesha County area, that there are a number of jobs out there, how do people in Milwaukee in 5326 get to those jobs if they're in a high zip code that doesn't have cars, but yet they are qualified workers to be able to work in Waukesha? So we really have to think about that and start really investing into regional transit and really coming up with some real solutions, maybe public-private partnerships, maybe business partnerships. There's all kinds of things that I think that we can do that we just have to start doing some bigger dreaming.
We're talking public transportation with two advocates, Lisa Jones there from MICA, the Milwaukee Inner City Congregations Allied for Hope, Cassie Steiner here from the Sierra Club, and you. Let's go back to the phones now. Robert in Greenville with thoughts on public transit. Hi, Robert.
Hello. How are you?
Good. What is on your mind?
Well, I listen on this radio every day,
and a great topic that you got going on. Like I said, I live in the Fox Valley area, which is Greenville, just outside of Appleton, and we have Valley Transit up here. And I have actually talked to a few of the bus drivers that actually run the buses, and the problem is their works, they are so limited in hours that they can work, and having quality drivers to do the job, they have to streamline their route to accommodate the, you know, main areas. So a lot of your urban towns like Greenville don't get even touched very much because they don't have any qualified drivers to do the job.
Robert, thanks. Cassie, is there a driver shortage?
Some transit systems are facing challenges in drivers. I think it's as much being able to pay for routes and pay competitive salaries as it is anything else. And we know that it's a consistent job for workers, for drivers. It's much more reliable than, you know, what a lot of people might compare Uber and Lyft. You have more consistent hours, you have more worker protections, and so there are a lot of benefits for bus drivers, but that competitive salary can only keep up as long as funding into our transit systems keeps up.
So a year ago, the Sierra Club and other groups put together this study on public transportation. You found barriers with transit systems all over the state. You talked with people all over the state. Can you give us an example of how what you're seeing on the ground in areas, how that affects transit users and where we go from here?
Yeah, I think we've talked a lot about the way that lacking transportation can impact us, whether it's not being able to maintain a job that you had because you can't get there reliably or not accessing healthcare when you need it. I think something that really stood out to me this past year, we had a Transit Week of Action and we're interviewing riders across the state. And I keep mentioning the BART system in Bayfield and Ashland because I was so startled by how positively people there thought about their transit system. We met a young woman who lived in one small town and took the bus regularly to get to Walmart, to get to her job, to go to the doctor. She said her favorite thing is riding the bus during the day to meet tourists that are in the area over the summer, and how that's such a lifeline for an area that is so dependent on our tourist economy and really struggles through the winter months. And I think that's one example of it really filling a gap. And I think thinking about where we go from here is looking at how we can invest in our transportation systems, how we can set up legislation that allows communities to invest in this in the way that makes sense for them, in a way that meets people's needs. So regional transportation authorities being one example. And I do have hope because transit systems that are invested in are seeing increased riderships, and we need to see that across the state.
Cassie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And Lisa, thank you for joining us as well.
All right, thank you.
Cassie Steiner is a campaign coordinator for the Wisconsin chapter of the Sierra Club. Lisa Jones is a community organizer with Milwaukee Inner City Congregations Allied for Hope. And they talked about the state of public transportation in Wisconsin, where they think the greatest needs are. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.